better off.
Hello, Amazing Avenue audio listeners. Welcome to episode 8 of A Pod of Their Own. I am Allison McCaig, and I am once again joined by my lovely co-host, Linda Surovich. Hi, Linda.
Hey, Allison.
And Maggie Wiggin. Hi, Maggie.
Hi, Allison.
So we are now starting with the state of the New York Mets. It has been possibly the Metsiest week in the history of the Mets, and that is certainly saying something, but the lol Mets has been turned up to like 11 this week.
I keep expecting to hear them announce that like Matt Harvey went on a bender last night and he won't be pitching tomorrow. Like that's kind of the only thing that could further Mets up this week.
Yeah.
And it was really only like 2 days. It wasn't even a week. It was Monday this all
we
happened.
Have 5 more days of Metsing for it to count as a full week.
Yeah,
what
we
could
do.
Happen in 5 days?
Oh, a lot. Don't give them that challenge, Maggie.
So I'll do a quick summary for our listeners, and then we can decide what lol Mets item we would like to tackle first. So in summary, the Mets lost 2 out of 3 to the Nationals earlier in the week and then got swept by the Marlins. So at that point, they were, 1-5 on the road trip and like had skidded to 5 games under .500. And everyone was starting to really think that this might be it for Mickey Callaway. They finally snapped their 5-game losing streak last night. But, everyone was starting to think this might be the end for Mickey Callaway. Then we find out that Lugo is hitting the injured list with shoulder tendonitis, which is a problem for an already beleaguered bullpen. Then we have the whole like Robinson Cano controversy, which we will tackle. Controversy, I'm putting in big, gigantic air quotes. And then we find out that Brody Van Wagenen is having a press conference, and we don't know what it's about yet. And everyone's like, oh my God, is he going to fire Callaway, even though he just gave him his vote of confidence, like, not hours ago? Like, everyone was like, Mickey Callaway is going to be the manager for the time being. It's okay. We have faith in Mickey. And then it was like press conference, and we were like, okay, is he getting fired? What's happening? And then
I did like the theory that they just gave him a vote of confidence so they could find his replacement. And obviously that didn't turn out to be true, but that would have been very Mets.
And yeah, I was gonna
I
say
I still think it might be true.
Definitely, yeah. Wouldn't have been out of the
realm. They were
of
leaking names like, oh, Mike Socha.
And yep. Everyone's like, nah.
Yeah. We definitely thought it was in the realm of possibility that they gave him a vote of confidence just so they could delay firing him so that they could find out whose replacement was. And then they called a press conference, and we were like, okay, guess they're firing Callaway.
The managerial equivalent of going to the mound and asking him how he's doing.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. My dad and I were actually taking bets about what the press conference was about, and I took like
one.
None of us guessed. I mean, how could you possibly guess what this press conference was going to be about? So,
which
yeah.
Our listeners must be on the edge of their seats, right?
On the edge of their seats. I had guessed it would be them firing Island because I was like, well, they gave Mickey the vote of confidence, but what about Island? But no, that's not the case, nor was any of the other scenarios that we had imagined. Instead, we find out that Yoenis Cespedes suffered a violent fall at his ranch and fractured his ankle in 2 places. At first, we thought that he fractured both his ankles. That was a misunderstanding during the press conference, but it turns out it was just one ankle with multiple fractures. However, it's extremely bad, folks. I mean, this is the type of thing where, he's already rehabbing from a major surgery. He's in his mid-30s, and he just suffered another very bad lower body injury. And it's kind of like, it's definitely the end of him this year, and it makes you wonder if it's the end of him as a Met, and it makes you wonder if it's the end of his career.
Which would be very, very sad, because he was one of, like, the most fun players to watch. There was always the chance of something jaw-dropping happening when he came to the plate. Like, he made the Mets exciting, and I loved that feeling. And Pete kind of has that now, but, like, yeah, I guess it would have been Piazza maybe before that, where it was just like, oh, impending doom is walking up to the plate, and I'm kind of miss that feeling.
And Cespedes was always good
yes.
when he was healthy. Like, he's yep. never had a bad season as a Met. He's just had short seasons as a Met, and that's
he
tough.
Literally hit a home run with no feet against the Yankees.
Yeah, he played one game last year and hit a dinger with two broken heels. Like, what?
Like the Duke can mash.
Yeah, and it's like, it's one of those things. I said this in the aftermath of his surgery. Like, everyone, you know, was, you know, understandably feeling pessimistic because it's a major procedure that has a really long recovery time. And everyone was like, oh, I don't know if we're going to see him this year. And it's right for the Mets to plan not to see him this year. But I said at the time, you know, he's a monster athlete. He's a beast. If anyone can come back from this, he can. And of course, like, making me eat my words, you know, freak things like this happen. Of course, you know, stay tuned on this because the lull Mets will continue because I have a feeling that the Mets are going to try to void his contract, which will be a whole nother, you know, can of worms.
Yes, the question of, so the official party line, to my understanding, is that he fell from a, quote, non-horse, end quote, which, whew, is like the most specific and non-specific phrase I've ever heard. Yeah. But of course, so if he did... If the non-horse was actually a horse, then, like, yeah, that's probably something they can void his contract for. And if it's something else, they might be able to void it for that, too. I don't know. I hate all of this because, like,
it sucks.
Maybe he did something that he was, per his contract, not permitted to do. And that would really suck. Because the other thing about Cespedes is, like, he is absolutely the Met I would most like to have a beer with. And it's not especially close.
No.
Like, there's no... There's no tight competition for that.
Like Linda said, like, yeah, we have plenty of, you know, good players on the Mets roster now. We have star players on this roster, but nobody gave the Mets swagger like Cespedes.
No.
Nobody. Nobody. That's gone now. Like, he was basically the swag of the Mets. Because, like, you know, you know, Noah Syndergaard has that a little bit. And, like,
he's got attitude,
yeah,
which overlaps with swag, but not 100%.
Yeah, that's, yeah. Like, there's, like, a Venn diagram, and there's some overlap between attitude and swag, but they're, like, different things. Cespedes very much gave the Mets swag, and I am sad that that will be not, like, I'm just thinking about the majestic bat flips, and my heart is breaking that I will not be able to see them again. It's really sad. And, you
I
know,
never
my
saw
heart
a
breaks...
Cespedes dinger City either. Like, I just wanted to see one. Like, that was my goal. When I go, I want to see Cespedes dinger, and it never happened.
And my
I will just
for
never
him.
Forget game one of the NLDS, that huge dinger he hit.
Oh,
I
yes.
Humble brag moment was at the game in the upper deck, and I swear I thought it was going to hit me in the face. It was so high and so, I mean, it wasn't that far because that's not how he hit his home runs. He hit them up and they were just so hard hit. They went out, but, like, for sure. That was, like, one of the most epic home runs I've ever seen in person.
Yeah.
Yeah. And no one can deliver like he could.
Nope. And yeah, it makes me sad for him too, because this is a potentially career ending thing.
And he loves this game so much.
Yeah. Yeah.
And fought so hard for it too.
Yeah. And like, you know, of course, like, players tend to go where the money is, of course. And the Mets paid him handsomely. But you could tell he loved being a Met too. And that's, like, my favorite thing when players, like, you can tell how much they love being a Met, because who the hell in their right mind loves this, like, terrible dumpster fire like we do? No one. Like, we are all, like, extremely messed up in the head because we, like, have some sort of, like, complex that we love this team. But to have players that love this team like we do, like, that nothing pulls at my heartstrings like that. And Cespedes was one of those guys. Like, he loved the Mets.
Yeah, it's really hard to watch.
Yeah, get well soon, Cess.
We miss you, Cess. We hope to see you in a Mets uniform again at some point. We hope that that dream will come true sometime next year.
#Team Team Cespedes.
Yes, #Team Team Cespedes. In the meantime, best of luck in your recovery, whatever that looks like. We hope that you can get to a place where you can play again. And even if you can't, you can get to a place where your life is not significantly impacted by this. And, you know... kind of in the opposite personality vein of Cespedes, but still heartbreaking about Seth Lugo. If fans of the pod may recall that Seth Lugo was my dude at the beginning of the season when we did the Who's Your Dude pod segment, that I said, you know, Seth Lugo's key to the success of this team, and that has been true this year, and losing him is a big blow to the bullpen, a huge blow to the bullpen. Now, the bullpen has surprisingly held its own so far, but we'll see how long that lasts. Lugo is the opposite of Cespedes in the sense that he's a very understated personality, but he, you know, in that understated way, he has been, you know, under the radar, very important to this team for like multiple years now, like since 2016. And he's just been there every year doing his thing in the rotation or the bullpen and quietly being very good. And it also breaks my heart to see him go down because he's low-key huge for this team.
I mean, he's a rock.
Yeah, and he didn't seem that concerned about it when they talked to him, which gives me some hope. But yeah. Still, it's never good when a pitcher has tendonitis.
Yeah. And like,
especially,
you know,
one as important as him, too.
Well, and also one who I like, you know, it's not as much of a red flag as if you heard he had like forearm tightness.
Yeah.
But he's pitching on a partially torn UCL.
Yep.
And, you know, you would hate to hear that, like, the tendonitis is a result of him shifting his mechanics or something. Like, shoulder tendonitis is bad enough. I really hope it just stays as shoulder tendonitis.
Yep.
Because it would certainly be very Mets if it did not stay.
Yeah. Because your body parts are all connected, folks. And, like, injuries in one area of your body can cause you to compensate in your mechanics or your gait, as the case was with Cespedes and why he had all those lower body injuries because of his heel calcifications. You know, these things can have domino effects. And so it makes me nervous, even though, like, maybe if you say it in a vacuum that he has shoulder tendonitis, it may not be that big of a deal. But for a pitcher who's pitching with a partially torn UCL, who has an injury history, who also had like spinal fusion surgery or whatever he had in his 20s, he's, you know, he's had a lot to deal with in his career. And so I really hope that he can come back soon and that it doesn't compound into something worse. But I remain very, very scared of that.
Yeah.
But we'll see.
So get well soon, Seth, too.
Get well soon, Seth. I will cover the one good injury news update that we have, which is that Michael Conforto, who suffered a concussion, it has been symptom-free, which is really, really good to hear. Because
that's fantastic news.
Because watching
that... And it's also
that...
good that the team was I don't want to necessarily say, like, conservative with their treatment of him. They were appropriate in their treatment him.
Yes. And so we know now that he's been symptom free for a couple days now. So that's really good. So hopefully he'll be back soon from the concussion IL, but you know, if it only does turn out to be a mild concussion and he ends up coming back pretty soon, that is a huge bullet dodged on the part of the Mets, because looking at that collision, it looked way, way nastier than it turns out it might be.
Yeah, and they thought, like, he'd been knocked unconscious for a second.
To me,
there was speculation that he was out. Yeah.
Yeah. And I was watching the, as you all know, I live in the Nationals broadcast area. So, you know, hearkening back to an earlier segment of ours, I was blacked out of the Mets broadcast that day because they were playing Nationals. So I was listening to the Masson TV broadcast, and they commented that they thought he was out cold. Like, they said it looked obvious to them that he was out cold. And I agree. They played the replay a few times and it looked like you couldn't tell because he was wearing sunglasses. So you couldn't tell if his eyes were open, but the way he just like dropped like a sack of flour, it was terrifying. Like,
you didn't tell he like not break his fall? Like,
no, he didn't. He just like flopped on the ground. Like a sack.
Yeah. If you've ever seen somebody fall to the ground unconscious, like it doesn't look like anything else.
Yeah. And you
like,
can
there's
tell...
no, yeah, there's no like holding yourself up or flopping. It's just like a drop.
Trying to break your fall. Yeah.
Right. And like, it's not just like the speed with which he fell like a sack of flour. It's like he hit, like the impact on the ground was hard. Like he slammed his jaw on the ground because he wasn't bracing his fall at all. So there was actually like two impacts to his head there was, like, the moment when he hit Robinson Cano's shoulder, and then when he fell again, he actually, like, his head, like, bonked again on the ground.
Take care of your heads, yeah. People.
Yeah, it's scary.
Oh, heads are rough,
they're
man.
They're tricky. Yeah. Like we've seen with Clint Frazier, it took him a really long time to come back from concussions.
Concussions are no joke. I mean, we've seen multiple Mets that have dealt with this, and at times it's been career-ending. I mean, Jason Bay was never the same. Ryan Church was never the same. Now, you know, Ryan Church was in part the Mets definitely, you know, screwing that up. So it's really good to know that they're, hopefully they've learned their lesson from that and they're not doing the same thing with Conforto now.
Yeah, and hopefully we've come a long way in, like, brain science, too. Like, you know what to look for and not, oh, put him on a plane. They did put Conforto on a train, which was the correct move, but Ryan Church.
And also, if I may say, a much more pleasant way to travel from D.C. to New York, if you're asking me.
Sure.
Take the train every time, y'all. It's lovely.
Yeah, agree. So I guess we'll spend the remaining time we have on this segment and talk about the, you know, Robinson Cano stuff. I say that with a sarcastic tone.
It wouldn't be anything if he had an 800 OPS right now.
It's, sure wouldn't.
It's the, yeah.
Yeah, but
the thing that you get angry about when being angry about the real thing is not helpful.
Yep.
Like, even today, Todd Frazier grounded into a double play and jogged to first, and Garen Keith did not even say one word about it.
And do you think there's going to be any articles about it tomorrow? No.
Nope, not a single one.
There are several
things.
And
Todd Frazier's making money, too. It's not just Cano.
Right, right.
So it's not about the money.
Yeah, there are several things that influence whether a player is written about and made the whipping boy of the media. One, does he make a lot of money? That's like a thing. You know, so yes, Frazier makes money too, but Cano makes more money, and the Mets just took on his giant contract, and so the fans are, you know, chomping at the bit to blame him for things. He's getting paid so much, and it's the same thing with, like, Cespedes dealt with this too, and still does, because now that Cespedes is, you know, even more injured, of course you have the contingent of fans. It's like, oh, we're paying him to do nothing. Mets are going to recoup that money, folks, either in the form of insurance or attempting to void his contract, so let's not weep over the Wilpons wallets on that one. But yeah, one factor is, does he make a lot of money? He'll get blamed. Another factor is, you know, is he not white?
Yeah.
That's another major factor. If he is not white, then the odds that he gets, you know, written about negatively in the press increase exponentially.
Lazy.
Yep.
Lazy dogging it.
It's
bad influence.
And it's one of those things that, like, if you look at each instance as a separate thing, you don't necessarily notice anything wrong. But when you take the overarching tone of criticism of the effort level on the part of Latino players, it is totally different than the equivalent for white players. It just is. You gotta, like, you have to take the step back, look at the big picture, and it's not a flattering one, even for, you know, I'm sure we love our Gary, Keith, and Ron, but, like, they have fallen for this line also, and it's not a good look.
No, it's not. And I mean, I said this a lot about, obviously this is a different situation than, you know, quote, laziness or dogging it or lack of hustle or whatever you want to call it. But I talked a lot about this in the offseason, about the difference in how Bryce Harper was covered versus Manny Machado in the free agent market, and, you know, the type of contracts they were going to get and their past histories as players when people were comparing the two. The coverage was very, very different. And there's one very obvious reason why that was. So, you know, that is factor number two. Are they not white? Factor number three, are they struggling at the plate already? And Cano is, you know, he's not been the worst player on the team by any stretch of the imagination. The Mets have had plenty of players that have struggled. But, you know, compared to his body of work, he has underperformed at the plate. So Cano has sort of the trifecta of not white, getting paid a lot, and underperforming at the plate. So that's, you know, the perfect storm to get, you know, hit pieces written about you when the team isn't doing well. Because this lack of hustle didn't come up until the team went 1-5 on the week and got swept by the Miami Marlins. Now it's suddenly a problem, despite the fact that Cano has been doing this for his entire career.
Yeah, and the fact that, like, it takes a lot more than one player to get shut out twice in a row by the Marlins.
Exactly.
I was just going to say that. Let's be real. Cano's lack of hustle is not the reason why the Mets are where they are. Like,
yep.
Everybody slumped at the same time, pretty much.
Yep. And there's aside from the fact that I am frustrated by this because the three factors that we mentioned are very obvious why he's being scapegoated, there are two reasons why this makes me angry. One, it distracts from the real reasons that this team is struggling. So because we're having conversations about Cano not running out double playgrounders, we're not having conversations about why the Mets are actually bad, you know? And so we're, you know, we're having these other conversations, which I'm not interested in having.
And also notice the difference, too. The national media was able to report on the Wilpons. But the beats all focused on Cano. Oh, JD Davis home run.
Oh, I was just hoping for that. That's excellent. Yay, and JD after, Davis.
Yeah, 4-3 now because Brian Dozier hit a home run to make it 3-1. But now we're winning.
Yay, good job, awesome. JD.
Thank you.
Heck yeah.
Yay, Linda. Bring happy, it with the updates.
Happy updates.
And also Dom Smith had a really solid pinch hit at bat.
He did.
He's been doing
he
a
did.
Lot lately.
Dom Smith has been, you know, very, very clutch. Solid. Very
yeah,
solid.
Right on. Yeah. But, back to my point, though.
Yes, thank you, as we were saying.
As we
but
were
the
saying.
National media has no issue going after the ownership, but the beats all focused on Cano, focused on Frazier's beef with Eaton, and I'm not a single... No, maybe there was one that I missed, but none of the beats, I don't think, had any articles today about where the problems really come from.
Nope. It's, you know, the outlets
it was
writing
Passan.
About. Yeah, it's Jeff Passan, it's Rosenthal, and it's the Ringer. So it's ESPN, The Athletic, and The Ringer. These are the yep. outlets that are writing about, you know, the actual problem with the Mets, which is ownership and not Robinson Cano running 50% on a ground ball. That is not the problem.
And so, people who don't have to worry about their access.
Right. So the second reason why it frustrates me is, and this is sort of tied to the fact that other players do this and no one talks about it, is that Robinson Cano has been remarkably healthy in his major league career, and he's 36 years old. He's doing this for a reason. He's doing this to preserve his legs to play over a full 162 game season. Obviously, he's not playing all 162 games, but he's playing 150 something games at this rate because the Mets don't give him too many days off. So, you know, except when they want to bench him for lack of hustle and not tell him that's the reason. and then he kind of outs it as he kind of was like, actually, that was a scheduled day off. And he said the quiet part out loud because they didn't tell him, we're pretending this is because you didn't hustle. Shh.
Well, and of course, every Mets thing that has happened this week and ever is further Metsified by absolutely atrocious communication around
yeah.
it.
Yeah,
like
exactly.
Let's not forget, is it really Metsing if we don't have at least 10 minutes where we don't actually understand what's going on?
Oh, yeah. Can we review the lack of communication this week? There was that little miscommunication where Cano was not informed that the reason he was benched was because of this peddled controversy by the media. There was the, whoops, he fractured both his ankles. No, only one, but twice. And then there was also the, Drew Gagnon is starting. Just kidding, it's no one. Just kidding, it's Wilmer Font. Just kidding, Drew Gagnon's really important to the bullpen now, so he can't start the game. He has to be in long relief, and then he just piggybacks Wilmer Font anyway. And I was like, well, that was a fun series of events. It doesn't make any sense why they did that. Like, they literally just flipped the roles of the two. They were, like, it was going to be interchangeable either way. I mean,
anybody talk to each other?
No.
It doesn't... I mean, I work remotely for my job at least one day a week, and I certainly communicate better with the people who I work with than the Mets do with someone who's, like, 2 feet away from them.
No, right?
Well, we even mentioned this, I think, last week. Well, Dom Smith said he was blindsided by his demotion. Like, nobody thought to tell him.
Yeah, right?
Like, yeah, at least, like, warm him up to the idea and be, like, set the tone of, you've been so valuable for us, and you know, we don't like to have to do this, but whatever. Like, no, it's a pattern, y'all.
You gotta take a situation and mess it up as much as possible.
Yeah.
And to make it as uncomfortable as you can for all parties involved. And then you got a true Met.
Yep. True Mets. So, yeah. Cano is preserving his legs for the long season. We on this podcast have no issue with him, you know, jogging when it's a routine ground ball. And it's clear that he hustles when it's important. If it's legging out an infield hit when he smells a hit, when it's legging out a hustle double like he literally did yesterday. Like, these are things that he is capable of and does do when the situation warrants it. But, you know, you can't...
The best players shouldn't hustle on every single play, because that is going to get you hurt.
Yeah, he's 36 and we have him for 5 more years. Like, what would these same people that are bitching about his lack of hustle say if he was on the IL with a hamstring strain? They would be complaining about that. So, you know, you can't win, right? So, you know, we on the pod don't care if Cano doesn't run 100% every time. Let's leave that for guys like Brandon Nimmo, who we love for doing that because they're a different style of player. We love them both equally. So, yeah, it's been a banner week in Metsdom. They possibly have never Metsed more than this. You know, but that said, even though it felt like last week really kind of felt like the end of the season symbolically, on paper it is not actually over. They can still do something about it. They can still sign Craig Kimbrell or Dallas Keuchel. They're still out there, and now they're going to get this money back from Cespedes' insurance, so they really have zero excuse.
Zero. What is money really, though? Isn't it just an idea?
Just an abstract
thought. Just a feeling. What if payroll was the friends we made along the way?
What if payroll flexibility was the friends we made along the way? When we get back, we will have an interview, an interview segment for you guys with Emma Spann, the managing editor of The Athletic MLB. So we're really excited about that. So stay tuned for our chat with Emma.
Beyonce, Ariana Grande, and Drake are talked about ad nauseum as celebrities, but there's one thing that's rarely discussed: their music.
On Switched on Pop, we go deep into the sounds of pop music to explain what it means, how it's made, and why it's so effective.
We talk with some of today's greatest artists, producers, and journalists to decode the musical logic behind our modern soundtrack and understand its role in our culture.
Switched on Pop will reveal for you how a secretive Swedish producer is behind many of the top 10 hits of the past 20 years.
And we'll uncover the ways that songwriters embed their political activism into today's most popular tracks.
We'll show you the surprising musical similarities between Cardi B and Taylor Swift.
And we'll even dive into the classical past to hear how the Jonas Brothers mirror Mozart's youthful party days.
I'm songwriter Charlie Harding.
And I'm musicologist Nate Sloan.
Join us on a journey through the world of popular music by subscribing to Switched on Pop on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app to get new episodes every Tuesday.
I'm Todd Vanderwerf, the host of Primetime, a new show from Vox.com. This season, we're tackling the American presidency on TV. Stories that capture the way television affects and reflects politics and culture. We'll take a look at fictional presidents who've changed the way we think about the real Oval Office.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
Good morning, everyone. Please, take your seats.
And how real presidents use TV to further their own goals.
What did you come here to plug?
Have you heard of the Affordable Care Act?
From the first TV president...
People have got to know whether or not their president's a crook. Well, I'm not a crook.
To arguably the last...
We are fighting the fake news. It's fake, phony, fake.
Primetime, from the Vox Media Podcast Network and Vox.com. Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
And welcome back. And now we are having a conversation with Emma Spann, managing editor at The Athletic, previously at Sports Illustrated and other places. And we're going to ask her about what it's like being at The Athletic, and along with other things. Hi, Emma. Thank you so much for coming on.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Awesome. So the first question I have for you is, you know, baseball reporting has, at least in our view as sort of outsiders, baseball followers, so to speak, changed a lot in recent years. And The Athletic is sort of a symbolic of that change. So how do you think that baseball reporting has changed in recent years with the growth of new media outlets like The Athletic and the decline of sort of older formats?
Well, I think there is still plenty of the older style of covering teams. I think there are still local papers and local sites doing the kind of traditional game story and news updates and all that stuff. You know, we at The Athletic, it was pretty clear from the very beginning that if you're asking people to pay for something, it can't be what they're getting for free everywhere else for the most part. And we've been trying to focus on, you know, features, on reported stories, on, you know, there is some breaking news, but more just sort of in-depth analysis and trying to bring something that, you know, that isn't going to be at a bunch of other places.
And I think we actually, this is Maggie, we had an interview a few weeks ago with Meredith Wills, who wrote some amazing pieces for y'all about the baseballs. And so that I always sort of will cite that as one of the things that you're not going to get anywhere else.
Yeah, that was such an interesting one too. And I was a little nervous about it because she was like, you know, I did all the experiments just like at home on these baseballs and I found this and I was like, can it really be right? But you know, I think it's been, you know, it's been proven out pretty clearly that in fact she was right. And that was a fun one. Cause I was like, this seems plausible to me, but I'm not an astrophysicist like she is. So we'll just have to assume that she knows what she's talking about and hope for the best there.
And it seems like that story is still developing too in 2019 now.
Yes, she is working. She is currently trying to dissect some 2019 baseballs because, you know, players keep telling us that something's going on with the baseball again.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, everybody, I mean, I think the data is there too. Like in April, how we were breaking all these records again. So yeah, it definitely seems like then a follow up is needed to that story.
We are on it.
So for you personally, so you kind of, we're talking about like the larger environment of baseball reporting shifting over the years. You personally, you were recently in Sports Illustrated. And then I think 2 years ago, you joined The Athletic when it was still just a little itty bitty baby in arms. So what was that like? Just professionally and personally taking that leap?
Yeah, I mean, it actually, it wasn't even 2 years ago. It feels like it's been a long time, but it was a year ago in February. So still pretty new. You know, it's interesting because the kinds of stories that we're trying to do are not that different. You know, the reported features are still, you know, are important at both places. The method of getting them to readers is completely different. You know, it was a very cool job. I was the baseball editor at Sports Illustrated. I was working with Tom Verducci and a lot, you know, Ben Ryder and a lot of great writers, liked my coworkers a lot. But once Time Inc. was sold to another company, to the Meredith Corporation, it was pretty clear to me that it just wasn't a very stable place to be because they made clear that they were going to sell it again. They're still waiting for that to happen. So they still don't know who's going to buy it. Like, it might all be fine. It might be... basically everyone just has no idea. So I was there at the time. My husband was also there at SI, and we were like, we both can't be here, you know, if it all goes to hell. So I had sort of been thinking along those lines anyway. And then The Athletic reached out, Paul Fichtenbaum, who used to work at Sports Illustrated, and said that they needed a baseball editor. And one thing that really appealed to me about it, aside from being able to focus on the kinds of stories that I like to do, is I really think the subscription model is sort of the best hope we have for sustainable journalism right now. You know, print journalism, obviously not the way of the future, and web, you know, the kind of free web content that SI was doing on their website, trying to be supported by ads, it's just not working, in my opinion. It's, you know, ads just do not pay enough. You can't make enough from web ads to pay for, you know, for employees, for editing, for production, for all that stuff. So I think, you know, subscription is, I don't know, you know, obviously don't know what's going to happen long term at The Athletic, but I can see a way that it could work. Like I think there's at least a chance that it could work, pretty good chance that it could work, which right now might be the best you can ask for in the media business. But I really do believe in that model and think it's the best chance we have right now.
Where do you see that going in the future? You know, so obviously you guys are putting out fantastic content right now. I am a subscriber to The Athletic, and I know that you guys have rolled out podcasts recently. So I started listening to the Mets podcast that you guys have rolled out. So that's a new thing that you guys are doing. But where do you see this model sort of taking you in the future? Like, what do you see maybe 5 years down the line?
Yeah, 5 years down the line, I don't know. I think they're just trying to grow, you know, if you can just grow to have enough subscribers, and it doesn't have to be a crazy huge amount. If you can convince, you know, enough sports fans, just like not even a huge percentage of sports fans, because there are so many sports fans in this country. You just need enough to be able to, you know, for it to pay for itself, to turn a small profit. I mean, I think, you know, the podcasts and the video are great. They're just trying to make, I think what they're trying to do with that, they're not trying to move away from the written word, which is still a focus, but they want people to feel like, I'm paying you this much money a year. They want you to feel like you're getting a lot for your money. So not, you know, that you're getting stories, but yes, you're also getting documentaries and you're also getting podcasts. You know, I think that's, but they're there to support, you know, the reporting, I think, first and foremost. Yeah. And I think, you know, it's like I said, I don't know what'll happen, but I can at least see a way where it would work. Whereas right now I don't see the way forward for web ads, basically.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So you're in an editorial position and in a largely male dominated field. And what's that like? How's that working for you?
Yeah, it's
well,
fine.
Obviously.
When I first started as an editor, I definitely had, you know, some occasions where writers pushed back, where they, you know, didn't want to listen to things that I was trying to tell them, and I couldn't always tell if that was because, you know, maybe I was young, maybe it's because I was a woman, maybe I was just wrong. you know, I started at Sports on Earth, which was in some ways similar in the sense that it was trying to focus on you know, high quality writing, but did not have the business model that The Athletic has, and, you know, may it rest in peace. So I definitely encounter early on. I have not really run into those kind of problems lately. I don't know, again, if that's because I'm working with, you know, with writers who are nicer, smarter, less sexist, or if it's because I'm more experienced and know what I'm doing more, or some combination of those two things. We have a really great staff. I have, you know, they're a pleasure to work with. The same for the most part was true at SI. So, you know, I would say it was an issue at times earlier in my career, but it's been a while since I had a problem with a writer where I was like, this feels like it's gender related, you know?
That's good. And also, I mean, I'll just take a moment to plug, not baseball related, but The Athletic is rolling out some really good coverage of other women's sports, including, yes, I believe, a lot of WNBA stuff that just came out recently.
Yep. They're launching a WNBA vertical with coverage of every team, which is great. And Hannah, the editor who's running that, is awesome. And it's good to see. And I think they're going to give it every chance to build and grow an audience, I think, I hope. And I'd like to see it happen.
And as a soccer fan, I'm really pumped about the expanded women's soccer coverage on The Athletic. Like, I got so excited when I saw that that you guys are expanding your women's soccer coverage, because besides the Mets, that is the thing I am most passionate about. So I was like, oh, right ahead of the World Cup, I can't wait. So I'm really excited about all that content. And it's been great so far. So
my husband and I watch a lot of the World Cup, you know, men's and women's, and I'm definitely looking forward to being able to read up on that too, so I can pretend like I know what I'm talking about when I watch the games.
Hi, Emma. This is Lynn. You've written a book. You're an author, which I am in awe of. I think that's awesome. Do you want to tell us a little bit about your book? It seems like it's a more personal book, and maybe how you wrote it, what went into writing it, what your experiences were writing it.
Sure. Yeah, that was kind of a saga. Yeah, it's called 90% of the Game is Half Mental and Other Tales from the Edge of Baseball Fandom. And it evolved in a very unexpected way. Also, it took forever. writing a book, so hard. It was also, I think it came out 9 years ago, basically. But I would have started writing it 12. So I was really young. So my 20s, I just got my first job in sports. So first of all, before this, I had a day job. I was summarizing like Z grade DVDs for an online retailer. So I would watch like Christian karaoke, or not even watch, we would just get descriptions of and write blurbs for Christian karaoke, like anime porn, all kinds of weird stuff. And it was really boring. So I was totally bored at work, and I started a baseball blog to like fill time while I was supposed to be working. And through that, I got hired at the Village Voice to cover the Mets and the Yankees, which is insane. And I feel like would never happen now. And I had like no sports writing experience whatsoever. And suddenly it was just like in the Mets locker room. So anyway, based on my work at the Village Voice, I got an agent and I got a book deal. But the idea was supposed to be I would follow the Mets and the Yankees in 2007. And the publisher was like, you know, they could go back, you know, could we have another Subway series? They could both be in the World Series together. And then what happened is that my editor at the Village Voice got fired, and everyone that he had hired got fired, including me. So I already had the book deal, but I lost my locker room access. And so I had, so we're like, all right, what are we going to do now? So I'm trying to still follow both teams. And then, if you remember 2007, the Mets had like a historic collapse.
No, the Mets didn't play in 2007. They canceled the season.
Yeah, that's
exactly. I'm surprised you don't remember that.
Yeah, I was there. It's so weird. Yeah, I was at that last game where like people were crying in the stands. Oh. Anyway, there was that. And then the Yankees got kicked out of the playoffs when Jabba Chamberlain got swarmed by gnats. So that was not a Subway series.
Just to clarify, Nats with a G, correct?
Yes, not the Washington Nationals. Actual small bugs who like bothered him so much that he got flustered and lost the game. So yeah, that season did not go the way that I, the publisher, had planned. So I basically had to start over again. And it became a essay collection. And it was, you know, I traveled to a few different places. I went to Milwaukee, I went to Taiwan, because it was the height of Chen Ming Wang mania. And I talked to a bunch of fans. And so it became like a bunch of essays about the different ways people are baseball fans and the different ways that baseball fans are insane, basically. All things considered, I think like I'm still glad that I did it. It was like very stressful. Again, like if you took it at the, but I got paid for the book and spread it out over like the 3 years that I was writing it. I mean, I was, you know, it was so, you know, pennies on the hour probably. And I worked a bunch of other day jobs. I was trying to freelance write, but I also needed like some more reliable income. So I worked at a wine store. I ghost wrote Dean's letters at the American University of Antigua, which is a Caribbean medical school.
Wow.
That's amazing.
I sold mittens shaped like bear paws at the Union Square Holiday Market, and like five other jobs that I can't even remember. So
that holiday market is a wild scene.
Yes.
Man, did you get like in any fights? I feel like there would be fights.
Actually, no.
Oh, well, that's lovely.
People were pretty nice about like the problem. So there's no bathroom. So you have to like walk like, you know, across the square to like find a store to use the bathroom. So you have to rely on other stall owners to like watch the stuff for you. Anyway, I don't recommend it. Also, it's very cold. You know, and all that time I was trying to write the book. So, and it was, like I said, it was a bit of a saga. I feel like that answer was supposed to be shorter, but
no, don't worry.
That's great.
Yeah, it was a journey. It was a journey. And I may one day write another book, but like not for a long time.
But we're all very big literary types here. So if you write a new book, please let us know, because we will definitely read it.
I definitely will. I think I would like to do it one day, but I think I would, one day I'd like to try fiction again, which I haven't written in forever, but
so do you think that's harder to write fiction?
I think it's harder for me. I don't know that it's like objectively harder. I know for some people it's easier. It's not what I used to write fiction when I was younger, not good fiction. But that's what I wrote. And then I, you know, became a reporter, and now I'm so used to nonfiction that I think it would probably be a pretty big adjustment. But that's what I like to read. And when I'm not, in the rare moments when I don't have to work or take care of the kid, when I get the chance to read, I always want to read fiction. It's a little bit of a, you know, the escapist aspect of it. You can sort of get out of your own head for a little while.
For sure. I can relate to that. So this is Allison, and I want to know what the shift was like, because you were talking about the Village Voice and talking about covering the Mets and the Yankees. I want to know what the shift was like for you when you started covering, like, Major League Baseball as a whole versus just your local teams, and, like, what that sort of shift was like getting to pay attention to, like, all the teams equally, and what that shift of mentality was like and how you approached it.
Yeah, it's definitely, you know, a very different way of watching the game. I still love watching baseball, but, you know, there's no kind of fandom left in me. It's for a particular team. It's just hoping for interesting things to happen, for good storylines, you know, maybe for certain players that you like or stuff like that. But, or for anyone that we have, like, a story coming up on them, you know, you want them to, you know, not mess up the story by doing anything differently, that kind of stuff. It's fun, though, you know, turn on the TV and just look at, like, okay, what's the most objectively interesting game going on right now? Or just, like, what am I curious about? Who haven't I watched in a while? What do I want to see? I'm sure I watch, you know, every team at some point. I still live in New York. I still probably follow the Mets and the Yankees more closely than other teams. So, like, you know, I will watch, like I said, basically every team, but I don't necessarily know, like, the fourth bullpen guy of the Mariners, you know, the way I know it for the Mets or the Yankees. But it's fun. I mean, it's, you know, it's a low stress, kind of more intellectual way of watching it, where it's less about emotion and more just about, like, what's interesting.
Yeah, I like it's funny because I sort of had that experience when I moved to Baltimore, because, like, I live in Baltimore now, but I'm obviously a Mets fan. So I'm from New Jersey. And I, like, it was nice to watch the Orioles because, they were good for a while, not now. They were good for a while when I first moved here, because I moved here in 2013. So the years, like, 2014 to 2016, the Orioles were very good. And so getting to be, like, emotionally invested, but at a distance, I'll call it. Like, I'm emotionally invested because it's the city I live in, but it's not my team. Was, like, really nice getting to watch baseball on, like, a very intellectual level, and, like, getting invested, but not too invested to the point where it, like, affects my mood the way the Mets do. So I can relate to that.
Big Pete just hit a home run, if anybody
wanted to
have.
And it was quite a dong.
Oh, my God.
Although they're reviewing it because he hit it over the foul pole, so we don't know if it was fair or foul.
Oh, no. Sorry, Emma. We have feelings.
This is how rabid we are. So, Emma, since you, you know, you talked about, you know, the difference between local and shifting to national, and now you get to follow all these other teams, for these three very hyper-focused Mets fans, what is your suggestion for, like, a non-Mets team to follow this year, or, like, a particular player on another team? Like, what are your favorite non-Mets storylines this year?
Though? Please save us from ourselves, Emma. Please save us.
Yes. We're begging. Well,
got a couple for you. So, obviously, you know, being Mets fans, I will not recommend the Yankees or anyone else in the NL East.
Thank you.
Yes.
I think...
Appreciate it.
I think they're already slumping more than they're supposed to be. The Mariners, although currently losing, are a fun team that is interesting. They're not necessarily, in fact, they will probably not win, but they will be less hopeless than the Mets, probably, and although equally cursed. That'll feel familiar to you, you know?
Yes, yes.
West Coast Mets, yeah.
But for a team that actually is good, I recommend the Twins, who are, you know, scrappy underdog types, but actually a lot of fun right now, and, like, legitimately good. And, you know, okay, being the Twins, that, yes, they are probably going to lose to the Yankees in the playoffs, like, just to warn you about that. But until then, it should be a fun ride.
Yeah, it was fun getting to watch the Twins very briefly when they played against the Mets for a two-game series. And I think that they will play them again, right, at some point, because the Mets are playing the AL Central this year. So we still have to go to Minnesota, I guess.
Yeah.
Get to see Williams Astudillo, who is pretty, pretty great.
Yes, he is.
The whole young crew there is pretty awesome.
Yeah, they're a lot of fun. I also watch a lot of Dodgers because my husband is a Dodgers fan. And they're less fun now because they traded away Yasiel Puig. But, you know, they're still a good team. who, you know, are very deep. They have, you know, they've got Clayton Kershaw, who I still love watching, and Cody Bellinger, and it's just, you know, Justin Turner, who you might recall fondly from his Mets days before he turned into Justin Turner.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't know if that's like too much. I feel like they're maybe too rivalish for the Mets, but they're
I've got too. Some Dodgers in my bloodline, so I can kind of, I can work with it, but the Twins is a really good, that's a clutch recommendation. Thank
well,
you.
It's also funny you mentioned the Mariners, because I went to the Mike Piazza induction ceremony, and there were tons of Mariners fans there, and they were all so nice, and, you know, it was just interesting to see baseball from their perspective, too, because they are kind of like the Mets. They're kind of cursed. Like they have the longest playoff drought. So I did kind of feel a kinship with them.
Yeah, but it might not be much of an improvement, I guess, is the problem.
No. It's more heartbreak.
If you want to be disappointed by a different set of players, fresh new faces to disappoint you, then that might be the team for you.
How can we resist? Just in, we are now a Mariners podcast.
Mariners podcast.
Quick, who are the Mariners? I'm looking them up now.
Jay Bruce and Anthony Swarzak, that I know.
Well, no, Swarzak got traded.
There you go.
Oh, yeah, Swarzak is not anymore. He got traded to the Braves, so he's back in the NL East. Hello, Anthony Swarzak. But yeah, the Dodgers, I mean, I still am kind of, like, I might hate them a little too much, but I hate them significantly less now that Chase Utley is retired. That is the main bugaboo for a Mets fan.
I right. hate that, them much yeah, less than I would hate them if they had beaten the Mets in 2015.
Yeah.
Right. Yep. No, that makes sense.
So, Emma, where can our listeners find you on social media and various other places?
I unfortunately am on Twitter at
nobody's perfect.
Just my name, Emma Span. If you want dog and baby photos, then I'm also on Instagram under the same name. It's basically just toddler photos at this point.
And you do want these toddler photos, y'all. I mean, look, I have my own curly blonde little imp, and I would love to just put her with Emma's baby in one room, and they would take over the world.
Yeah, and you know, they would destroy everything in sight, probably, but in a nice, friendly way. and that's it. But otherwise, you can theathletic.com/MLB is the site that I edit, and go there for your national coverage of all 30 teams, including your newly adopted Twins and or Mariners or Dodgers. But yeah, we have, you know, one thing about The Athletic, you know, even aside from the national site, like just every team is covered, and every team has, you know, good stories on every single team. So if you're ever like, hey, I wonder what's going on with the Diamondbacks, you know, we have head on over to our Diamondbacks site and find out.
And appreciate that The Athletic called out the Wilpons even as recently as this week. So we're always on board with outlets that are, you know, have the stones to call out the Wilpons.
Well, and a good fight. And Ken, that was Carrig, right?
That was Ken Rosenthal. I mean, actually, I think Mark may have also called out the Wilpons. He has at various points. But, you know, Ken, if you read his stuff, is like a generally pretty like restrained you know, I would say almost mild mannered, and he sort of went off, but rightfully so,
deservedly so.
Yes, deservedly so. But yeah, when Ken goes off, it's like you know they had it coming.
Yeah. So you can check out all of the fantastic content over at The Athletic MLB, and you can check out Emma on Instagram and Twitter. So thank you guys for listening. And when we get back, we will have walk-off wins like we do every week. So stay tuned.
Hey, I'm Spencer Hall.
I'm Holly Anderson.
I'm Ryan Nanny.
I'm Jason Kirk. And we're the hosts of the Shutdown Fullcast, your Avengers of College Football podcast. It says here in the script I'm to riff on what that means. And basically what I mean is it's all already spoiled.
Every Tuesday, we talk about everything from cooking disasters to pro wrestling to unfashionable pants we wore in middle school.
We also do talk about college football every now and then, like mascot fights, announcers fleeing the booth early, and unfashionable pants that coaches wear now.
If you want to take college football exactly as seriously as it should be taken, subscribe for free on Apple Podcasts or in your favorite podcast app.
Hey, everybody, I'm Neil I. Patel, editor-in-chief of The Verge, and this is The Vergecast. VergeCast is the flagship podcast of The Verge. Every week, we cover the latest in tech news and reviews. We take a critical look at what is going on now and next in the world of tech. The show is hosted by me, our executive editor, Dieter Bone.
Not your friend.
And Paul Miller.
It just feels like there's something wrong with all computers, though. Don't you think that sometimes?
We do that on Fridays. And on Tuesdays, we have an interview episode. I've been talking to all kinds of influential people in and around the world of tech. We talked to Microsoft founder Bill Gates about his philanthropic efforts.
You can design systems without having to reveal any individual's particular medical record.
Journalists and academics like Lina Khan, who thinks that we should be doing way more to break up giant companies like Amazon and Facebook.
I think in hindsight, allowing Facebook to buy up both WhatsApp and Instagram proved to have been the wrong call.
And we talked to tech CEOs like Vizio's Bill Baxter, who explained exactly how smart TV manufacturers make their money.
It's about post-purchase monetization of the TV.
It's ads.
It's ads. Check us out every Friday to hear about everything in tech, from new iPhone leaks to breaking down Facebook's ongoing issues of privacy to just me and Paul ranting at each other about the role of the government. And check us out on Tuesdays when I host the interview episode. Subscribe to The VergeCast wherever podcasts are served. We'll see you then.
And we are back with our final segment of the week, as always, where we do walk-off wins, where each of us talks about what is making us happy this week. So, Linda, what is your walk-off win for this week?
My walk-off win for this week is at my job. Every year, we raise baby chicks. We get eggs, and then we put them in the incubator, and then we hope for baby chicks. And this is the first year that it was on me. Well, a couple of my coworkers helped, but so I was very nervous. I was terrified that I would screw up and we would get no babies this year. And I started off on the wrong foot. I put the eggs in upside down, and then I had to flip them after they had been in the incubator for a couple days. And then you have to keep the humidity at a certain temperature, at a certain range. And, you know, overnight, it would drop really low. So we were afraid we were going to get no chicks. We had 10 eggs. And 9 hatched, and they were, and I actually saw one pop out, and it was just amazing to see, you know, life, basically, see the little beak popping through. And so, you know, I was very happy. This is the most chicks we've ever had, so it's like, maybe screwing up and doing everything wrong is the secret to having cute, fuzzy baby chicks. But they're leaving us tomorrow, so I'm gonna be sad. They're going off to the farm to live their little chicken lives.
But, yes, they should.
Yes, but so I was happy. I had 9 fuzzy buddies at work for the past week after they were born. So that's my walk-off win.
What's happier than fuzzy animals? Nothing, honestly. So Maggie, what is your walk-off win for this week?
My walk-off win is super timely and relevant to where everyone is right now, but I finally saw Avengers Endgame.
Yay!
The babysitter life is a tough one, man. I did love it. I really did. It was, you know, I'm also a Game of Thrones fan, so I've had sort of like a mixed experience on that this season, but it was really great to go to the Avengers with my husband and the kids at home with their awesome aunt, and just get to see like a really well thought out cap on what has been a very fun movie franchise for me. I've not seen every MCU movie. Babysitters are expensive, but saw most of the key ones. Thor is my favorite, but it was a really fun movie. It was really cleverly put together. They did, I won't give anything away, but they kind of, you know, you always want your last, you know, that your last segment to kind of call back to earlier parts of the story. And they did that in a really clever and fun way. So it's a good movie. If you are even more behind the times than I am, you should go see it.
Did you need tissues?
I did. I actually, like in particular at the beginning, that hit me extremely hard.
Yeah.
Anything with family is a danger zone for me personally. There will be tears.
Yeah. I'm glad you liked it.
Yeah. I might have to, I mean, I'm totally ignorant. I, like, haven't seen, like, any superhero movies. I've seen, like, a couple of them. So I'm very behind the times on that. But I may have to see this movie just because of Citi Field. So I may have to just, like, give it a little peek.
It's appropriate.
Yes. So my walk-off win for this week is not Mets related, but it is baseball related. And it's about a book I just finished. We love books on this pod, and we're probably going to talk about books fairly often. We've already done a whole segment about books. But I just finished up a baseball book called When the Crowd Didn't Roar, which is a book about the Orioles-White Sox game that was played with no fans in the aftermath of the uprising in Baltimore in 2015. So those of you that know me know that I live in Baltimore and have done for the past 6 years. So I was in Baltimore during that time. And I, you know, I felt the acute pain with everybody else with this city. And I felt really, really sad during that time because, you know, I had spent the past 2 years before that, when I moved to Baltimore, telling all my family and friends how much I loved it, how much the national reputation in Baltimore is not actually what this city is. And then, you know, that happened and, you know, all of a sudden CNN comes swooping in and wants to make the national narrative of Baltimore something that's straight out of The Wire, when in reality, that's not the way this city is most of the time. And I felt the pain of the people who were in the streets because they've been ignored by decades and decades of, you know, systemic racism. And it's just, it's so tough to watch your city hurt like that. And I felt like, you know, I felt really, really hurt. And so to read a baseball book about that game and how, you know, it was both haunting but also healing for the city, it was such a well-done book. It was done by it was written by a former Baltimore Sun columnist, for many, many years. And he did a fantastic job with this book. And I just, you know, it reminded me so much of how I felt after the Piazza 9/11 home run. It reminded me a lot of that, the way that baseball has such a healing power, not only for a city, but the way baseball has a healing power for me personally and helps me, you know, deal with tragedy. And I went to the first, game after the uprising when there were actually fans allowed back in the ballpark. So after the game with no fans, they went to Tampa. That was supposed to be a home series, but they changed it to a road series because of the circumstances in the city. So they went to Tampa and then they came back home. And I went to that very first game at Camden Yards that fans were allowed back in. And it was just, it was probably the most emotional time of my time in Baltimore. And this book just captured it perfectly. So, you know, it was a cathartic read, to say the least. So if you're interested, if you're like a baseball nerd, or if you're interested in what happened, because it wasn't just a baseball book, it was all about what led up to the uprising, different people's views about it. And it was really good about covering that too. So if you're interested in either the circumstances in Baltimore in 2015, or the baseball game, or both, highly recommend you check this book out. It's called When the Crowd Didn't Roar. So thank you so, so much for listening to another episode of A Pod of Their Own. You can follow the show on Twitter at A Pod of Their Own. You can also email us, aa.apodoftheirown@gmail.com. You can follow Amazing Avenue on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Amazing Avenue, and continue to check out all of our fantastic content. Maggie has a Dominic Smith piece coming down the pike. We have some other stuff lined up for you. I am at Petite PhD on Twitter. Where are you, Linda?
I'm at Linda Cerevich.
How about you, Maggie?
At Maggie162.
Fantastic. So you can follow all of us on Twitter. The original music, intro, and outro to this podcast is by Bunga. Let's go, Mets. And don't forget, there is no crime anymore.